Here's the thing that's stuck in my head. I know that that Elvis fans or anybody that knows too much about him will have this question, but I wrote this in a piece recently. I said that there are very f just about every white rock and roller of the 50s and 60s borrowed black song stylings. In just in the singing of rock and roll, they all did it. He was, however, the first guy to make it big as a white guy, getting really big in the rock and roll realm. And he owed, I think, black culture and black performers more than almost anybody. I mean, nobody had a bigger IOU than Elvis Presley because he was like the guy to first to really sort of break out and become the a guy who sang black but was white. So that would lead me to think that in the relatively benign and relatively unchallenging days of the early 60s, before the whole 60s ferment kicked in, that it would have been an absolute no-brainer for him to have joined all the celebrities who took part in the August 1963 civil rights demonstration in, because he just owed, he owed it. He felt he should have had that feeling that, I got to do something for black culture. I mean, they did so much for me. Could you try and explain why you think he never went there?
My hunch is that while everything you just said is true of him in terms of the size of the IOU he's carrying in his pocket toward them, and that they should be carrying from him, that at the same time, to be fair to him, I think a cyclone of complexity had descended upon the life of a rather ordinary person who had come from very ordinary beginnings, and I think all of the massiveness of it all was bewildering to him. And I'm not trying to give him a get out of responsibility card, but I am saying that I think, to be fair, one of the things that happened to him that didn't happen to all those other celebrities was the full weight of the American military empire coming down on him in this Faustian bargain they struck with the colonel to put him into uniform and make him sing GI blues instead of the real blues. So, that is the embodiment in many ways. It's the symbol of the contradiction in which he's living at that time. He's got a debt that he owes to black America, but he's towing the line for white America and its imperial self-concept. And he comes back John Wayne, as Jerry Schilling says, and he went away as James Dean. And I think it's in that shifting part of his life that those years happen to be taking shape. And I also think it's at that point where he's found himself so tremendously in the thrall and control of the colonel. And as Chuck D said, at a certain point, there was a migration away from blackness toward the white and the sequins and all that. There was a migration again away from that which got you here. And Elvis is not alone in forgetting where he comes from. Elvis is not alone in moving to the next place. I think in symbolism, he stayed where he came from and that he loved Memphis and he loved his mama and he felt at home in the South, but that doesn't mean where he really came from. And I think there is a certain abandonment of where he really came from that's implicit in those years of spending too much time in Hollywood and Vegas and Hawaii and far away from that which formed him. So he's seduced by a lot of things, and I think he's pressured by a lot of things. And I don't know what I would have done to calculate and navigate within all those same pressures. I'd like to think I would have remembered better who shaped me, but I can't just judge him callously with no understanding of the full range of forces unleashed upon him that nobody else really has faced.
You haven't, did you ever in the course of making the King talk to Priscilla informally, just off the record, just chatting,
No,
getting, no.
I never did. I never did. I knew that to ask Priscilla to be in this film, Priscilla's very involved with the organization that owns Elvis's likeness and that manages that, and I knew that this was a film they were not going to be friendly to, and therefore I knew it was a film that Priscilla might not be comfortable being in, and I also knew it's not a film with a prurient interest in the mechanics of their relationship, which nobody can know but themselves.
Yeah.
Anyway, and that's really just not the kind of film it is. And so, just out of elegance, I chose not to go there.
Okay. What did you think, by the way? Go ahead.
Say again. Well, I was just going to say that, you know, my job here is not to give Elvis a pass or not give him a pass for the issues about race. He did what he did, and he didn't do what he didn't do, and we are history that stands in a degree of judgment of that.
Mm-hmm.
What I think we are supposed to take from it are questions about ourselves. The president has constructed concentration camps for juveniles at the border.
Yeah.
What are we doing about it as we talk here on the phone right now? What is the step up that we are called upon to make, and are we doing it? Because otherwise we're violating the premise of the movie, which is that I don't think everybody should believe in kings and queens. We all matter.
Mm.
So if we all matter, we shouldn't specially look to Elvis to carry the water of doing right by his society. We also look to all of us, to ourselves writ large. How many of us are doing the right things by questions of race, gender, economics, justice, etc.? And if we are, great. And if we're not, get to work. And his story is a cautionary tale and all that stuff for me.
Mm. So it's Chuck D, right? The guy who does the quote. He says, Elvis is a flat-out racist, right along with John Wayne. Do you think that was a fair thing to say, given...
What he says is, he doesn't say it that way. He says that sucker was simple and racist, sucker was simple and plain. Motherfuck him and John Wayne. He fucks both of them equally. He doesn't so much distinguish about the specifics of the racism. I think Chuck D's... Do I think that Chuck D's comments at that time are fair in the original song? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. It just struck me as I didn't quite believe it. I don't think that, given that Elvis knew a lot of people of color in Tupelo, and he went to the churches and he used to sing with them and the whole thing. It's just it's hard for me to accept.
Have you ever heard Werner Herzog on the subject of truth?
No, but it's fascinating. Tell me what.
I was on a panel with him once.
Yeah, tell me what he said.
He said there's a difference between the accountant's truth and the ecstatic truth.
Okay.
Meaning that the accountant's truth is the facts and figures and episodes and moments on the.
Hello?
What Chuck D alluded to when he called Elvis a racist and fight the power was the ecstatic truth of how black America feels being abused by white America and having their heroes, having white heroes forced upon them and black heroes undermined, having their earning power compromised when white earning power skyrockets. So in that, it's a perfectly valid thing to say. Is it fair distinctly, specifically to Elvis Presley as a person, or is it really just the use of Elvis Presley as the icon that he was to make a point about the hijacking of iconography?
Yeah.
As that, it's an ecstatic truth he asserts.
Mm.
What I think Chuck D does in the film is he gets into the weeds with me of where the accountant's truth lies, and he says, listen, the Elvis who was once upon a time willing to perform black-sounding music when other white people wouldn't have been willing to do that, he's actually an admirable sharer of culture. It's only years later where, as you mentioned earlier, where Elvis might have stepped up and didn't, that Chuck D might say, well, where is the Elvis who loved those people and their music and their culture so much that he wanted to share it with the world? Where was... We see where they were when he needed them.
Mm.
Where was he when they needed him?
Mm.
And that has... What Chuck D once said to me in the interview was, he was nodding along within the radiation of racism in his society.
Mm.
And that's racist enough for Chuck D to say, if we're going to be sensitive to our own role and how world events go on, inaction can be as active as action.
Right. Interesting, the point you didn't clarify when you were speaking. I'll just say that anyone listening that hasn't seen the film, when you say he went away as James Dean and came back with a kind of more of a John Wayne-ish attitude, you were referring to his 2-year stint as a GI in Germany, right?
Yes.
That's what you meant, and I guess how did
Elvis went away from
exactly. Yeah, go ahead. I didn't want to stop you.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was a point that Jerry Schilling made. Elvis, when he arrives on the scene in America, he's got sideburns, he's singing black music, he's unleashing a sexuality that nobody had allowed into American living rooms on a television before, and he's got all this threat that he poses to the American system, and everybody, and church groups and conservative groups are protesting him and everything else. He goes away to the military, and as John Lennon said, they didn't just cut off his... give him a crew cut, just cut off his sideburns. It seemed like they cut off his bollocks, as John Lennon infamously put it. Yeah. And I think the point is he came back and was a different person, and I think that's largely, don't blame him necessarily. You might also notice that he came back and had a world of pressure weighing on his head. Mm. He's now the king. He's this extraordinary force of nature. He's got the whole country celebrating him and then, you know, putting him on the $100 bill. I mean, it's just he's suddenly a representative where he had been a radical.
All right. Now, you're going to be slightly irritated at me for asking this, but it's just really a benign question. And I asked you this before, and and I want to just understand it fully. The only film one of the better films, if you ask me, of the that he made in the 50s is Loving You, and I'm particularly interested in seeing this film someday in a high def for, you know, because it was the only film that he it was made in shot in VistaVision, which is a large format. Yeah. You know, it really would look great. Now, you said that it's somehow tied up or benignly neglected by the estate, but the question would be, I know that there's maybe not the greatest elements. There's some kind of 35-millimeter print, you said, at UCLA, but again, every single, to my knowledge anyway, almost every single film he's made has been put out on home video, on DVD mostly, and there's been a couple of Blu-rays, like Jailhouse Rock and one. But why wouldn't they make an effort somewhere? I mean, why not? Well, why not put it out? And I'm sorry to bother you with this question, but what
you don't bother me. You don't okay. Me
All right.
Here's what I understand.
All right.
Here's what I understand. The estate of Elvis Presley, which is now really controlled by a branding company called Authentic Brands, which is the best I understand it.
Right.
That branding company has a unique level of control over his likeness, where even when you go to a studio and they really do have the power or the ownership of the movie and they could just grant you the rights, they are under lock and key in a way to make sure, fear of God, that they have to get the approval of that organization before doing anything of the kind. So there is a strange degree of control when people seek to use Elvis's likeness. I have no idea why Loving You is hard to come by. I found other things, by the way, that were hard to come by with him in high quality.
Uh-huh.
But the weirdest thing about it is that the reason it's hard to figure out why it's where it's situated is that he's got stuff owned all over the place. It's just that the core likeness ownership is controlled and blocked by this central organization.
But why then would they say okay and approve other movies to be put out and yet say no on this one? What would be the problem? It doesn't make any...
I'm only the wrong guy to ask because I don't have a permission relationship with them of any kind.
Yeah.
Because this is a movie that is not, you know, that's not the this is a piece of social commentary, and it's not, you know, so they're doing that kind of licensing for commercial products that are using Elvis's likeness.
Okay.
I have no idea why, particularly because it's so beautiful looking, you wouldn't find it in a better quality.
Yeah.
I'm happy to look into it more for you, by the way, because you're getting the answer that came from me trying to get a hold of it because I thought it looked so good and wanted it in the movie that way.
Yeah.
And I crashed into the limits of what I could get. But I did know that the places where a print might be would have asked for permission, which I would not be granted.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that.
Right.
So if you're me, you're going to run into the same thing.
Mm.
If you're trying to do an Elvis series for some, you know, totally non-social commentary purpose and you want to celebrate him and this and that, my guess is you'll get it.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I never would lie about something like that and say, hey, I'm doing something that's not social commentary. I have to tell them like it is. So I'm kind of, you know, I lose them at hello.
Yeah. All right. Well, the last thing I had in mind was that it was the failure or his reluctance to after. I mean, when he came back with that wonderful 68 live thing at NBC Studios, everybody thought that the man has found himself again. He's rediscovered his rock and roll spirit, and it was a great moment. And it would have been so much better if he had taken that the spark of that, of what was behind that performance, and gone out and actually toured. But he didn't tour, and he didn't like get in touch with the country. You know, he kind of decided on Vegas instead. And as Ethan Hawke says to you in your film, you know, he always went for the money every time. He never went for the soul of things. He went for the biggest payoff. I'm repeating what I've seen, but I just wanted, if you wanted to riff on that a little bit, just, you know.
Do you know who did the same thing?
Yeah.
Obama. When Obama got elected, there was a moment where he could have toured the world and been carried on the shoulders of the entire human race that was so overjoyed to see a part of the American story made true, delivered on, American dream made real in the person of his election, and the world was ready to carry him on their shoulders, and the last thing anyone wanted to see him do was head right to Washington and become a creature of the system. And do you know, he spent November to January in Washington, didn't tour the world, didn't come back to America on the shoulders of the masses of people in this world who wanted to see America be a leader among equals. And I think by doing that, he robbed himself of the kind of integrity and the kind of global momentum that would have truly defined him as a president. And now he was just up against, how am I going to do in the sort of Cuisinart of Washington politics? And I think that was a strategic error of vast proportions. But why did he make it? I think for a similar reason to the reason that Elvis Presley didn't grab on to the success of the 68 special, which is that systems promote ideas of the limits of the possible. They tell you that the way that if you're a celebrity, you don't just get out of your car and go shake everybody's hand. You have an important thing to get to, and you have a reason for being different than everybody else, and you shouldn't go back to Memphis and hobnob with those people who got you where you are. That was then, this is now. There's all these catchphrases which characterize life, and they characterize life, in my view, in a very demoralized and uninspired way, and all too often even the best and brightest cave to those assumptions. And I think Obama felt, getting elected, wow, I've just done something absolutely epic and historic, but I'm not supposed to be an angry black man, and I'm not supposed to this, and I'm not supposed to that, and I'm not supposed to this, and I shouldn't just be all around the world having everyone love me. I should, you know, get Washington reformed as quickly as I can. And I understand it, but it was business as usual, just like for Elvis. Business as usual before the comeback special was pretty self-destructive, and then he was right back at it.
Right.
That's where the money was. That's where the predictability was.
Right. One last thing. Last night, you told me that some fellows out there, older white guys, gave you personally some hate mail. Is that after seeing your film, or just after seeing the trailer, or hearing about it secondhand?
If you go look on YouTube, you can see it, but you can see it in a lot of places. If you go look at the trailer on YouTube and go look at the comments, you'll see the kind of comments that I've been getting. And I also get them directly. People find out how to get in touch with me, and I get bizarre notes that are full of extreme claims and hyperbole and anger and upset. And you'd think I've gone after, you know, the Pope himself.
Well, and you're not really going after Elvis Presley in this film, it seems to me.
I agree. Apparently, to say anything other than the same runnings of the old 1950s mythologies, that's sacrilege. That's all it is.
What's really interesting about your film, Eugene, is that you there's never a moment when you don't feel a current of worship and love and camaraderie for the guy he was from 54 to, say, 58, that guy. And that's, you know,
what's funny about that?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what's weird.
Yeah.
And I hope so, but I'll tell you what's really weird is that the older guy, everybody always says to me how beautiful the young Elvis is.
Yeah.
He's captivating, so good looking. And yeah, of course we can all see that. He's he's the blueprint of good looking for the latter half of the 20th century.
Yeah.
But I find the older Elvis, the age 42 Elvis, who's about to lose his life, I find that person incredibly beautiful because he's a real person. He's broken. He's overweight. He's struggling. He's trembling. He's full of humanity. If you watch him sing Unchained Melody, the young Elvis could never sing Unchained Melody. He didn't have that in his soul. He didn't have that yet accrued the way people look beautiful when they get crow's feet. I find both beautiful, and I hope there's reverence for both. And as you can see from my rendering of Unchained Melody at the end of the film, that's the most beautiful I ever saw Elvis.
Yeah.
Even though the young one is so conventionally beautiful, other one is to me the kind of real beauty.
Okay, interesting. Okay.
So.
Well, I hope that I hope everybody jumps into your film because it's got a great duality going toward it. It's thoughtful. And it's emotional, and yet it's saying some really, I think, very profound truths about our country and about who we are, and or where at least where a lot of the country is. And it's one of the
you and me both, man.
Yeah,
I hope so too.
One of the bell ringers. So.
You know, and I don't know. I mean, it's some hard stuff in there for people to get to take in. You know, and I think people are resistant to take in challenging stuff, and I hope that doesn't. Get in the way for people because it's obviously what they need to do. I think we all need to be thinking deeply about a lot of stuff. So,
you know, the funny is that the film never makes you feel that you're coming from some ivory tower perspective. I mean, you're on the road. You can smell the grass. You can feel the culture. You can feel people. It's very much of a ground level people person film. It doesn't feel pretentious or snide or dismissive. It's a very, you know, upfront film in a soulful, emotional way.
I really hope so. Yeah. Really appreciate you saying that.
Yeah. All right, Chief. We'll talk. Take care.
Super cool, man. Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Bye-bye.